we've got about 60 million acres. Make sure everyone's got at least a quarter of an acre. And then you've got a contented population that are not being coerced into working for somebody they don't agree with, don't trust or don't like. It's the rentier class. These are the people that want to sit on their backsides and do nothing and just rake it in from everyone else. And I think that they should be jailed, personally.
Have you ever owned land?
No, never.
No. Would you own land?
Yes.
Would you like to be a peasant?
Look.
Today I have a special treat for you, which is a conversation between me and a man called Tony Gosling from a land rights campaign group called The Land Is Ours that was very active in the 90s and early 2000s. They campaign peacefully for access to the land, its resources, and the decision-making processes affecting them for everyone, irrespective of age, race, and gender. So as you may expect, this was a very wide-ranging conversation, and it's of particular interest because this group was founded initially by George Monbiot and was the thing that sort of got him started, and we do discuss him briefly. Every part of this conversation threw up a lot of different questions, but it all ties into the ideologies we talk about on the channel, so I found it very, very interesting, and I hope you do too.
So my name's Tony Gosling. I'm a freelance journalist here in Bristol, and I've taken a kind of strange journey, really, over the years from the 1980s working in the family business in aviation to the 90s, where I did 5 years at the BBC. Then from 1995 to 2005, I was working with a guy called George Monbiot, who's quite well known now. At the time, we thought he was an environmentalist. I think most people who worked with him in those days realise now he's something different. But that was called The Land Is Ours, and it was a land rights campaign where the basic premise was to go and find bad landowners, occupy their land. We also did a historical 350th anniversary of the diggers in the Civil War, where we occupied a plot of land on St George's Hill in Surrey, where the diggers occupied back all those years ago. And we spent 10 days up there getting a lot of publicity around the whole idea of land ownership and the lack of proper distribution of land and the way it's changed over the years. But that at St George's Hill, the irony is this place where the diggers wanted to make the earth a common treasury for all those years ago, is now like the Beverly Hills of Britain. People like Cliff Richard live there. It's a massive private gated estate, mega high security and that sort of thing. So it was quite good fun getting in there. And you know, we had quite a decent number of people, several hundred people, to do that in 1999. And then I got back into broadcasting again. So I've been on FM here in Bristol for nearly 20 years, actually.
So there's quite a lot of things to get into there. I'd like to discuss your view on environmentalism and some of the mainstream environmentalists. But I think first, we'll talk about the history of it, because a lot of the actions listed on your website are framed in historical terms. You hark back often to historical movements that you either try to replicate or celebrate with what you've done.
Well, I think so. And the other thing we were talking about at the time was linking a lot of this to what's going on now. I suppose the two main ones were the Kets Rebellion, which was just great fun. We turned up outside a derelict, smashed up old mental hospital on the outskirts of Norwich, set up camp there for a month or so. And the idea was that was the 450th anniversary of Kets Rebellion, which people, except people in Norwich, most people in the country don't know what happened. They had a massive rebellion. Robert Kett, he was a landowner that had taken the side of the local peasants. He could see how devastating the enclosures were. And he was ruling Norwich and a lot of Norfolk from underneath an oak tree. What he did is he got hold of the various big landowners who had privatised the land around Norwich. And he got them locked up in Norwich jail for stealing the land. And of course, he had massive support from many of the people who had witnessed all this, these evictions going on, and the land being all turned over to production of sheep from mostly from vegetables. And obviously, many people had grazing. the thing to understand as well is that the system of land tenure in those days was different. It was mainly the copyhold, which was just passed on through the family. So you couldn't lose your home because of a mortgage or something, because the bank couldn't sell it to anyone else. It could only go through your family. So that was the system was being overthrown and overturned 100 years before the English Civil War in Kett's Rebellion. But then in 1999, we did the Diggers action on St. George's Hill. And that was a major part of the sort of end of the English Civil War in 1649, when Charles I was executed. A whole bunch of people just turned up on St. George's Hill in Surrey, led by Gerard Winstanley, who was a prolific pamphleteer. And he had a lot of support from printers in London who had been being oppressed and suppressed during the Civil War to print all his pamphlets about this concept of the earth is a common treasury for all. So if the king is now dead, the landowner, then all this land just goes to the people. And so that's why they set up on some common land and started digging and creating a little farm, growing vegetables, that sort of thing.
Do you want to sort of talk us through your view of enclosure and the earlier land rights movements that you feel you're continuing? Perhaps
it was the landowning classes, the feudal classes versus the merchants. And obviously the merchants won with Cromwell. The merchant classes wanted to evict the population of the UK, of England, to go and work in factories, because they were planning. This is something obviously which happened, an industrial revolution and an empire. This is, I think, the empire was one of the main reasons why they wanted to get people off the land to go and work for them and make stuff, make ships and God knows what else. So eventually, when it comes to the 1630s, Charles I starts to impose massive fines on the people who have been enclosing up to the English Civil War. And this is where things turn really nasty, because these people don't want to pay fines for things which were legal when they did them. And you start to get a great deal of organization against King Charles I. He was being advised by the church. Look, we've got people living in ditches across the country in terrible distress. Mm. And so really, the English Civil War was a battle between the feudal classes, the landowning classes, of which the king obviously is the head, and the merchant class, the new merchant classes, who were traders. They were serious professionals. And of course, the London livery companies. And they were professionals who were making money. And they were making money out of all these changes, where they suddenly had a lot of cheap labor around. This is great for them. The merchant interests wanted the land for themselves. And they would call it modernization. Look, if we control the land, we can get lots more off the land and out of the land.
Yeah, but it was the landowners who enclosed.
Sorry?
It was the landowners who enclosed.
Yeah. The merchant classes were doing the enclosing, really. But the feudal class weren't really on this bandwagon to make loads of money and create an empire. It was two factions within the ruling classes that were fighting each other. And of course, I mean, I personally prefer a feudal system, in that you have a relationship with your local feudal landowner rather than with a bank that might own or a merchant that might own something from afar. And of course, we had all this sort of trouble if we could just mention Ireland, for example. You've got the famines, etc., caused by these absentee landowners, mostly in England, who were farming Ireland to death. And that's one of the things that caused the famine. So you really want to have someone local who you know, respect, you pass in the street as your local landowner, rather than some sort of faceless company or corporation. Even though these corporations argue quite rightly, the merchants argue quite rightly, well, we can make the land more productive. And they did.
So you actually look relatively favourably upon landowners of this period of enclosure?
Well, certainly the feudal side, yeah. I'm very much more of a royalist, because I could see that Charles was trying to stop this mass depopulation, and he was trying to stop the enclosure and privatization. I mean, in a way, all the privatization we're seeing today, through the whole Thatcher era, and it's carrying on today. This was one of the first big privatizations that ever happened in the world, actually. and it led to mass urbanisation, the Industrial Revolution and empire. And I think we've just got to understand how all this fits in. And it's almost like we don't know the world the way the countryside used to be before. I think there's one village in Nottinghamshire which has never been enclosed, Laxton it's called, and it's just a different atmosphere. Now, I'm not saying that modern farming is a bad thing, but this is the context we're in. We've been slowly but surely, the population of England, particularly Britain, obviously, has been made landless. You know, so we're rooted in the land. It's our country, supposedly, but no, we have to float around on it, and we've got no rights to its resources, and we've got no rights to somewhere to work or live. And that's a process which really kicked off with the enclosures.
Yeah. Okay, I would be less favourable towards the landowners of this period. After your talking, a few decades later, King James, who followed Charles II, had the same dispute with enclosing landowners. There were the Midland riots against enclosures here, but people were so concerned about depopulation and the social effects of it that he tried to fight the landowners, essentially, and passed laws that said you couldn't cause a household to decay by enclosing its land, and then the landowners essentially ignored it. So I suppose I am agreeing with you in the sense that the power was not in the hands of the king, but I would say that it was perhaps the landowners rather than merchants who were driving this. Gerard Winstanley is this figure who was in the original diggers movement that you hark back to, and I have had a cursory look at his Wikipedia page, and he was essentially a townie. He was a merchant in London who became bankrupt and then moved to be a cowman in Surrey, and then inherited some land through his wife that he later sold and then went back to London. But he was the leader of this movement who had great popularity and influence, I think, because people were so scared about depopulation following these enclosures. But I just wanted to ask you about his position as a townsperson leading this agrarian movement, and also the fact that he himself owned land.
Well, he was a big campaigner against money, as I am. You know, I don't think we need money. People might say, oh, well, that's just pie in the sky. Actually, the whole point of using money is because, he used to call it the horrible cheating, which is buying and selling. Winstanley was also a bit of a visionary. I can remember reading some stuff about him in the 1990s, actually maybe by him, where he said that the death sentence should be reserved for people paying a lawyer. You know, that they should represent themselves, they should speak for themselves in court. He saw the legal system as totally corrupt. He was a great writer. And at the time, one of the monopolies was the church. Another one was printing. And he managed to find a whole bunch of radical printers to print all his pamphlets up and got distributed around the country, mainly printed in London.
Right. So just to compare Winstanley to yourself then, have you ever owned land?
No. Never.
No. Would you own land?
Yes. But I think, you know, for example, I look at the way land is used here in Bristol. We've got a massive area in St. Paul's in the city centre, which is a land bank. It's about 7 or 8 acres right near the city centre. I'd like to see that used.
Well, Winstanley, I think, was what I would call a townie. And is it safe to say that you are a townie?
Yeah, I was brought up in southeast London. I've mostly lived in towns, apart from a lovely year in Elterwater up in the Lake District, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. It's fantastic, yeah. Actually.
Would you say that your movement is fundamentally urban in its membership?
I think so, yeah. I mean, most of the people. I mean, we've got some subscribers who are landowners, small landowners usually. But the point is, I suppose, that it's just around this whole concept of land ownership, because as Winstanley says, it's a free gift to mankind. So you can own, you know, I can own this cup, right? I can own my car, I can own my phone. But do I really own the land that's underneath me if I've got a title to it? Well, the fact is, no, you don't. Actually, the Crown owns it. And if the Crown really wants to use it, it can take it from you. Kevin Carhill's done loads of work on this. He's the ex-Sunday Times Rich List journalist who wrote a book called Who Owns Britain? And in there, I think it was about 2000 that came out, and Kevin was working on land ownership at the Sunday Times back in the early 90s, because for the rich list. So the idea is, you know, a lot of people hide their wealth in land, masses of it. And of course, the king is no exception, right? And the king, as well as, I mean, the royal family generally, as well as fat big families like the Rothschilds, they keep themselves, as he said, from having worked there. They keep themselves off the list. The really big landowners and the really, really wealthy are not even on that rich list. And Kevin's understanding is really good. I think if you can see just how distributed and how well and how unevenly owned the land is.
Can we just explain in a bit more detail how you view land ownership in, you know, estates and stuff? Because here you're saying that it's sort of bad that these people own so much land, but then earlier you said that you would much prefer to have like a local feudal lord than a corporation. So I feel like in your view there is a justification for landlordism.
Well, I mean, one of the good things I think is the massive amount of private homes that people have been able to buy since World War II. Kevin points out that actually this is, ever since the enclosures, the most private land that people have had. I mean, it's a complicated business because ideally you have rights on the land, but you don't completely control or own it. I mean, that's the way things, I think, should work. Is that, you know, you have if it's a small plot, yes, you can do what you want there pretty much. Obviously, you don't want to be polluting, making a mess for people around you. But if it's a big landowner, of course, you should be actually more of a steward and sharing the resources, whether it's wood for people's fires and this sort of thing. And that was the traditional system. So I think if you want an example of a good system of land ownership, the old crofting system, which is still exists in Scotland, is very good. So you have rights to, although you've got a big landowner that supposedly owns it all, he doesn't really control much because it's the crofters that own the smaller plots, and also they have rights to graze on the hills. And so that old system is probably the only system in Britain that still exists, which is an old-fashioned medieval style sharing of the land between a so-called landowner that's a big guy and lots of little crofters. And the crofts, by the way, you can't just sell them on the open market. They again are like the copyhold. You can only pass them down through your own family, so people don't use their, and even if you're not using the land that's attached to the croft, you let a neighbor use it. You rent it out to a neighbor. I mean, say you're doing IT or something and living on a croft. To me, the crofting system is probably the ideal system of land tenure, and I think we should see it right across the country.
Very interesting. Well, yeah, in my view, I don't like landlordism, essentially. So I would be much more in favor of small owner occupiers, essentially. You could argue that even on our, you know, small farm, we are oppressed by various forces like government regulation and supermarket pricing and this sort of stuff, but we don't pay rent and there's no paternalism, and I think that is more or less the ideal form of land tenure. But
rent is a disaster. It's the rentier class. These are the people that want to sit on their backsides and do nothing and just rake it in from everyone else. And I think that they should be jailed, personally.
Okay.
Someone that's actually what they're doing, in effect, is kind of farming people. They're saying, you know, you've just got to pay me every week for the things that you need to live. Now, what kind of relationship is that? Of course, you're right. Landlordism is a disaster.
Okay, but you do want a type of landlordism. You want a benevolent landlordism that oversees community.
I think security of tenure is number one. Nobody should be being threatened with eviction. Nobody. And only if you're, you know, say you're some sort of maniac, I don't know, maybe running a drug den or something, in which case there can be some sort of intervention, yeah? But this threat of eviction, I think, is one of the most pernicious in the world. It means you can't plan for the future, for your kids, etc. You've got to be constantly worried about where your next paycheck's going to come from. And you know what? Over the years, it's totally undermined our quality of life. But those that are just making money off of other people's basic needs, get rid of them. Let's just put them in jail or just take the land off them.
Yeah, but then why Can you explain the ideal role of a landlord? If a landlord, because to me that's almost inevitable. The landlord collects rent. There is inevitably an insecurity of tenure if a farmer doesn't own the land. Why then do you think that the ideal form of land tenure would be a crofting system with a landlord? Could you not have crofts without a landlord?
I think you probably could, yeah. I mean, the thing is, with a crofting landowner, they don't do much. They're not really involved. You have to have somebody, I suppose, who, I mean, for example, with that system, the landowner can be fined for doing the wrong thing, just as anybody who, say, for example, their sheep get out and eat somebody else's vegetables or something, they can be fined. So it's a more of a level playing field. So I don't, you know, I just think the idea that the feudal system wasn't, it wasn't the same as the landlord system, really. So you'd have a feudal owner, you'd have a aristocrat who was, their job really was to mainly to be involved with the crown and the defense of the country so that they could muster troops if necessary. They weren't there to sort of knock on your door and say, come on, where's your rent? There was no such thing. They would take you to go and fight in a war for a while, maybe, possibly. And that was probably a total nightmare. But no, I think, you know, if you think about maybe crofting without a big landowner, fine. But you do need to have a system. Of course you do. Like all our commons actually have a system for managing the common to make sure that people don't take the mickey.
Yes, yeah. But I would just argue that you don't need a landowner to do that necessarily. Would you? Would you like to be a peasant?
Look, I think the main thing I would like is just not to be in the situation as I am now, where anything goes wrong, I can be kicked out of my flat. I think this is the main problem. And when you have security of tenure, I mean, we've got a campaign which was started last year, a campaign to abolish eviction, because we're now in the situation in Bristol, for example. We've got at the highest prices, rent outside London. And we've got these companies coming in, building these massive student blocks where you get a tiny little space to live in and you're supposed to pay over £1,000 a month to live there. And so this is taking the mickey, really. And the thing is, we're not producing anything in Britain anymore, hardly anything in terms of industry. And so this has become the industry. Let's just make people pay for where they live. And as a result, people are actually, I mean, for example, through the inheritance tax on homes, particularly in London, where homes are so well high valued, people are losing their home. They can't pass them on to their kids anymore, which is a total disaster. So you're being taxed all the way to buying a house, and then you're being taxed when you die to make sure your house isn't passed on. I mean, it's getting beyond a joke, and we need to redistribute, as I said.
Your defence of the aristocracy is very similar to what Lord Lymington was arguing, you know, several decades ago, which is that the benevolent landowner is a leader of a community and stands in the face of capitalism, which inevitably destroys the community. And the reason I think he's such an interesting character is because I think that he genuinely believes he's the good guy, and that what he wants is genuinely in the best interests of the people. Which you're suggesting.
Increasingly, our system rewards the greedy and the rich. That's the main problem, I think. It's the same. The same is true within, even in the world of banking and finance. If you're a ruthless bank that launders money, that finances drugs, then you do very well. People like HSBC have done incredibly well, and the smaller, more ethical banks get crushed by them because they can't compete. The aristocracy are very much like the middle class or the working class. There's some good and some bad, and the other thing is that they are not necessarily capitalists. If you look, there's loads of villages around which are estate villages, which are basically like housing associations or council housing, which is low cost housing owned by the aristocrat and maintained by them at generally low rents, you know, compared to what you're getting if you were to try and buy something. So I think the idea of demonizing the aristocracy or the middle class or the working class, this is all silly stuff. It's not actually a class war we're in. It's a war between whichever class you are, people who are giving a fig for their fellow man, or else people who are trying to use their position to acquire more and more wealth. And of course, this is, you know, you've got people like the Duke of Westminster, Duke of Buccleuch, the massive landowners. These people are pernicious. They're really, you know, avaricious. Mm. They want more and more all the time. But there are, you know, sort of lesser aristocrats who actually manage their estates extremely well, allow loads of public access, and they're the ones that are being targeted, I think.
If we could briefly touch on Guy Shrubshoal and George Monbiot, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, you pulled me up on it before, on their views of land ownership, because you have got some ties to them, and also I think they define the sort of public view of enclosure and land distribution in this country. They sort of have this view that the aristocracy own too much land in this country. I mean, who owns England? The sort of premise of that book is the shock value that the aristocracy still own a lot of land.
So what, do they want BlackRock to take it over? They want the BlackRock to be the big landowners, do they?
Well, the objection I have to it is that they say that the aristocracy have owned all this land, and the aristocracy are, you know, shady, sort of have this dirty capitalist worldview, which, you know, I might agree up to that point. But then they say the problem with this is that it's destroyed a lot of nature, so they want to rewild everything. Whereas in my analysis, rewilding is a continuation of aristocratic environmental ideology and serves to funnel taxpayers' money into the pockets of large landowners to control land and not work. To me, it seems like an aberration. They're on one hand bemoaning the aristocracy and sort of pointing at them as these, you know, great capitalist bugbears, while at the same time demanding that we make loads of public money available for nature.
Well, look, I could say something about Monbiot, because everyone was horrified when he came out, because what he got his Guardian column, a lot of it was on the back of his writing and the work he was doing with us on land rights. In the 1990s with The Land Is Ours. I mean, he was the main figure that set it up, and a whole bunch of us came in behind it. And we had a great time doing these land occupations. It's great fun. But George came out at the Fukushima nuclear disaster with the tsunami. He suddenly came out as pro-nuclear, and we were all like, well, what on earth is this all about, George? You know that nuclear power is all linked to nuclear weapons business. You know that the stuff it produces, this reprocessed nuclear fuel rods, is radioactive, megally toxic for tens of thousands of years, and that it's just not the way. You know, if you're an environmentalist, you want to be using less energy, not all this nuclear. And now we're in the situation where coal has been demonized. I don't think it's anywhere near as bad. I mean, we're...
So just to pause you on that. So you're there making an environmentalist case for coal, essentially. You see, I think I would argue that nuclear is low carbon and therefore more environmental.
I'm certainly not into the whole industrial revolution, everyone burning coal thing. But certainly in places like power stations, trains, this sort of thing, I have absolutely no problem with it at all. There's, I think, an enormous exaggeration going on with the whole zero carbon agenda. It's actually a market they're trying to bring in. This, I think, is where the banking system wants to go. It wants to have its version of massive enclosure, digitizing the whole of nature. And so that's my dispute with Monbiot, really, is that he sees a market solution. I see a much better solution would be to take the all of the dependence on money out of it, particularly for the basic things we need, like water, food. All these things can be provided at very, very cheap and at cost. And of course, they were.
Interesting. A lot of what you're saying, though, I think is in line with a lot of the origins of the environmental movement. And actually, I think, although I don't agree with everything that you've said, I think the fact that Monbiot doesn't agree with you is a great weakness of his. I mean, people are forever asking me to talk about Regenesis. I've got a copy of it here. And I think what's really strange about this is that he takes what he characterizes as a very left-wing anti-capitalist perspective. But in his view, the capitalists are the farmers, essentially, and he wants to sink us all and replace us with corporations that will produce food in factories, which he thinks can be done in cities, and you have, you know, single cellular organisms fed on gases and whatnot. And this is left wing sinking all the family businesses and having corporate control of the food system. It's very, very strange to me.
He's being a bit of sneaky, and he's trying to con us effectively. I mean, a lot of what he writes about, is good. But then, of course, he wouldn't be able to maintain himself as a credible columnist if he didn't write something worth reading from time to time.
Yes. Yeah, I think what him and Guy Shrubshole sort of get wrong. I mean, maybe this is because they're townies. Obviously, the town is a slightly different cultural arena. And I think maybe
they've got an agenda, and their agenda is part of this financialization of nature.
So just to finish off, because we haven't really touched on the inheritance tax, but as I said, I am sort of surprised to see that people who believe what you believe might defend my demographic. And I'm pleased to see that you are doing it. But do you want to just talk about why you think land ownership can be justified?
Well, look,
or, you know, however you may define, you know,
small landowners, acceptable. Of course, you know, any, the thing with people like you is that you know the land and you've been there for generations. In fact, I think the idea of trying to take land off people using the inheritance tax, who've had it for generations, is dangerous, because what you're doing is you're destroying the care that your great 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 grandparents put into the land. The other thing is that you know it very well. You know the animals that live there, the plants, how to manage it. It's a bit like having your own home that's been in the family for generations, which, you know, you can still see bits and pieces that your great grandparents put there, and saying, well, no, you're just going to be evicted now. We're going to get someone who's going to pay more rent, so get out of the way. So I think connection with the land is really deep rooted and important. I mean, obviously, if you go back before, pre-medieval times, right, to the years of Alfred the Great and people like that, it was a common knowledge that everybody had to share the land. The idea that this was all just yours or yours, no. You had somebody in that region who was responsible to the king for that area, but they didn't think that this was their private possession. That now has become, they've become completely obsessed by this thing as just something which is private property. And as these companies buy more of it up, so more and more of us are completely cut off from the land. In fact, I think, you know, you can't say you're British if you don't have a stake in the country, if you're just floating around on the surface being exploited by someone else that does own it.
Well, no, well, I thank you for that. I think that's actually quite a remarkable expression of empathy for my demographic, of which you are not a part. So I think it's quite wonderful that you understand how we feel
towards... And I toot the farmers. If I see a tractor now, I'll toot it, you know, because I can see the struggle that you're having now with finance capitalism.
Well, Tony Gosling from the Land Is Ours campaign, absolutely fascinating stuff. I'd love to have you on again to cover all of the stuff that we missed. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ollie. Thank you.